This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. Now, this week's program is going to talk about a few things that I think are a little difficult for all of us to really accept about ourselves. And I'm talking about what happens to us as we age. Not only physically, things start to fall apart, wear out, wear down, but also mentally. What happens to our mental capacities as we age? Forgetting where we put our keys, or maybe temporarily forgetting a friend's name. But at what point should we start to be concerned when we really can't remember things? Or be concerned about those we love when they can't remember things? So coming up later on this program, Carolyn Rosenblatt, who spent 10 years working as an RN and is currently an elder law attorney, is going to talk about when you should pay attention to memory loss as it relates to what they call financial capacity or ability to manage your financial affairs. So this is one of the hardest topics for families and individuals to face. So just pay attention coming up later in the program with Carolyn Rosenblatt.
Now, what we want to cover on today, we've talked a lot of topics here about retirement. Now, one of the topics, I think we did this about a year ago, is where to best retire. Where are the best states that are friendly for retirement, a nice climate, a lifestyle? Now, every year, CNBC does a special on the 10 top states in terms of doing business. They just completed it, and along with it, they did the best states to live in. Now, here's interesting facts. Some of the best states to do business on, and they did it for a number of reasons. They looked at the cost of doing business, the economy, how well it was, the infrastructure, workforce, quality of life, technology, business friendliness, education, cost of living, and also access to capital. Now, number one was Georgia. Number two was Texas. Utah, number three. Nebraska, four. North Carolina, five. Minnesota, number six, Washington State, seven, Colorado, eight, Virginia, nine, North Dakota, 10. Now, it's interesting when you take a look at it from what are the best states to live in. Different criteria, cost of living, access to medical, lifestyle, weather. In the top 10 states to do business, four were states that included the best states to live in. On number four was Minnesota, number six was Washington, number five was North Dakota, and number eight was Nebraska. Some of the other states that they listed as best to live in, Hawaii. You know, we all heard about going there for a vacation. Vermont was number two, number three was New Hampshire, and then number seven was Massachusetts and Maine. Now, one of the reasons we're going to talk about this is where you decide to retire can have a great impact on your retirement. Think of the cost of living. What does it cost? I don't need to tell you if you live in New York, you live in California, it's very expensive to live here. Housing. Our definition of a millionaire in California is a homeowner. How about access to health care? Think of how important that is as you get older. Access to education. Maybe you want to take classes. And of course, weather. And let me throw in another factor, and that's taxes. Now, it's not just income taxes. It's sales taxes, property taxes. And in some states, we can be talking about estate taxes. So there are a number of issues that are a deciding factor that you may have to face when it comes to planning your own retirement.
Jim, you know, as you were mentioning all those things, it sounded like a list of financial reasons to pick a particular state to retire in or a particular location to retire in. When I think about the conversations we usually have with our clients, sometimes their reasoning is more on the emotional side of things. What I hear a lot from them is, you know, I really want to be near my kids, or I really want to be near my grandkids, or I really want to stay near my friends. I've got a really great group of friends here with a really great lifestyle. I don't really want to leave. And some, they often mention affordability too, but what I hear a lot from clients really has to do a lot more with family sometimes, family and friends, social network, than it does with actual affordability. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things when you look at all of this, there's two issues here when you're planning your retirement. There's the personal side. Maybe you want to be near your kids, your friends. And then there's the financial factor that we talked about, cost of living, taxes, housing. And so these are some of the big expenses that you're going to have to weigh. How much do I have to look at the personal side? How important is that to me versus the financial side? The three big ones to me are the cost of housing, taxes, and medical care. And a lot of you may be deciding, well, gee, you know, I want to stay here because this is where my kids are, or I want to be close to my kids, which may entail moving to another state. But let me just tell you this. If you take a look at your kids, kids move around. So just because you move to a state because, you know, your favorite son or favorite daughter is living in a state, they could get transferred. They could change jobs. They're saying right now a person getting out of college may have 4 or 5 job changes throughout their working career. And that may entail moving to other states where the jobs are. So changing jobs, that happens frequently. But once again, you know, if you want to take a look at, you have the financial aspects and then you have the personal aspects. And of course, the personal aspects are the very things that we're talking about here, you know, being close to friends and family.
I was thinking, Jim, you know, when you start planning ahead or considering a possible move in retirement, thinking probably one of the first things you do is sort of weigh in your mind the importance of ranking the financial issues versus how important the emotional or family issues are for you. And when you make that decision to make that move in retirement, think about, do we also make this move after we retire? Do we make this move before we retire? There's just a lot of thinking that has to go into this, a lot of advanced planning as far as the timing of the move, as well as the location of the move as well.
Yeah, and in some situations, you can make definitive plans. Let's say you plan to retire in 5 years, you're living in New York, you vacation, you know, during the cold winter months, you vacation down to Florida. You've gone down to Florida a number of times and you've made that decision. Hey, that's where I'm going to retire. I'm going to get out of the expensive state of New York. I'm going to go down to Florida where it's sunny all year round, plenty of medical facilities, no income taxes. If you know for sure, and you've scoped the place out, you know that's exactly where you're going to be, well, then you might make plans ahead of that time when you make the retirement decision. Maybe you go out right now and you buy, let's say, a home, lock in the price, and you turn it as a rental while you're, let's say, living in another state. But when you're not sure in terms of where you're going to be, you might want to wait till you're retired to reassess that situation. Where are your kids? Where do you ideally want to live? Will you stay where you are now? Does it make sense? Maybe if you're in an expensive state, to move to an inexpensive state, or maybe you live in a state where real estate prices have just gone through the roof, as we've seen here in California, or it's more expensive or overpriced. And right now, you have to understand the economics of the country are shifting. The Central Corridor is becoming one of the more favorable places to live, not only from cost of living, taxes, but also where much of our country's natural resources, if you think energy, are taking place. That's where they're being developed. North Dakota is now producing more oil than Alaska. And so the economics of the country are also shifting towards the Central Corridor.
You know, it's interesting you should mention economics, Jim, because if I remember correctly, when you were talking about some of the criteria for the best states to do business and the best states to live in, obviously cost of living is a major consideration when you're thinking about making a move. Now, over time, all of us are going to experience inflation in the cost of living, especially if you think about the increase in your cost of living over a 20 to 25 year span of retirement. You can really see prices double over that period of time. So something to think about is maybe you can afford to live where you're living right now, but will you still be able to afford to live there in 10 years, 20 years, 25 years? Now, the challenge really starts to come in. If you've got a portfolio, you've got an income situation that's handling what you've got going on right now, but it's not really geared to handle any form of inflation. So how do you handle that? What do you do with that? What about if you have sort of unexpected medical expenses in later years? Again, maybe your income flow is handling your medical needs right now, but is it going to be able to handle them in the future? So one of the main things you think about when you're thinking about relocating in retirement is this cost of living situation. And also, and this is really important as far as access to medical care, you know, hospitals, long-term care facilities. Just a little aside here, Jim, I'm thinking about some of our clients who've retired to rural Idaho from states like California. Now, this is nothing against Idaho. I grew up there. It's an amazing state. I love going back to visit, but it doesn't really have the best access to healthcare in the world. And I'm thinking about certain clients we've had who've moved there, had major medical problems in these tiny towns where there's no doctor able to deal with their situation. They've had to be, you know, life flighted out to Spokane or another big city to take care of their medical issues. So when you're thinking about making this move, not only the cost of medical care, but the availability of medical care and long-term care facilities really should play a pretty important role in your decision to move, because it can make all the difference between, you know, living longer in retirement and the opposite.
You know, another factor too, Kathleen, is economics. And I'm talking here about taxes and housing, because let's face it, housing is a major expense in states like New York, Hawaii, Oregon, California. Taxes play an ever-increasing role in terms of your expenses in retirement, not to mention the fact of what you're paying to buy a home or own a home and live in this state. For example, here in California, our tax rates go all the way up to 13.3%. You start adding that to federal taxes, and all of a sudden, taxes are taking a big bite out of your retirement income. And remember, Social Security for many couples today has become taxable, with many couples seeing up to 85% of their Social Security subject to income taxes. So, you know, here in California, just about everybody is in the 9.3% tax bracket. So think of cutting 10% of your expenses just in taxes could be a major savings. And also, if you take a look at areas like Florida, Texas, Arizona, New Hampshire, Tennessee, North Carolina, and even some of the central corridor states, where a couple hundred thousand dollars can buy you a heck of a house. Here in California, probably won't even buy a garage. And the other thing, too, you don't want to find yourself in retirement where a good majority of your net worth is tied up in your house, because that's not producing any income unless you go to a reverse mortgage, and hopefully you don't have to get to that. So you don't want to get yourself in a situation where you have a lot of your assets are tied up in the equity in your home, because that's not doing you any good. Yes, it's a roof over your head, but it's not giving you retirement income, which allows you to not only maintain your lifestyle, but do the things you always dreamed of doing when you retired.
And Jim, I think this point of advice about not having too much of your net worth, you know, tied up in your home when you're in retirement is especially true for people who are living on the edge of their income as it already stands, and a lot of their capital is tied up in something that's not producing any income. So it can become a real big issue. And I'm thinking about a case where this was a situation with a couple we worked with where this was exactly what was going on with them. Michael and Brooke Bullocks. I'm just thinking about their situation, Jim, and what they were going through. Michael actually retired in 2012 when he was 64. He's now 66. His wife, Brooke, is 59. Brooke is a teacher's aide, elementary school teacher, and she was retiring when we talked with her, and sort of had a situation where, you know, Michael had retired a little early because he was working for a big pharma company. There was a merger that happened. A lot of people got, you know, asked to take early retirement package. Mike thought about it and said, yeah, you know what? I think I am ready to retire, spend a little bit more time on my hobbies and my family. Challenge is that Mike took this early retirement package, and combination of low returns and low interest rates, just really having a hard time making ends meet. And his other problem was that he was really skeptical about the stock market. So he kind of came to us in a situation where he was rethinking his decision to have retired early, rethinking his portfolio, and just really not sure what to do next. And the challenge really was is that Michael's Social Security was coming in at $28,000. His wife, Brooke's pension coming in from her salary as a teacher's aide, which was two-thirds of her salary when she was working, came in at around $30,000. So they had around $58,000, $59,000 coming to their home in income. But the challenge was is that their basic living expenses were $70,000. So even just the difference between their basic living expenses and their total fixed income coming in, the Social Security and the pension, was, you know, already over $10,000. Add to that the fact that they like to travel and entertain, another $15,000. Now we're talking about a total cost of living at $85,000 versus a total sources of income producing about $59,000. That's a pretty big difference as far as income versus cost of living. And where this really got to be a problem, Jim, wasn't so much in the income gap as it was what was producing the remainder of the income needed to meet their spending requirements. And the problem really was is that most of their financial assets, roughly half, were tied up in their home here in Rancho Bernardo, about $900,000. And they did have a $300,000 mortgage on it, but still, you know, $900,000 tied up in your home, $600,000 of that being equity. That equity in your home isn't doing anything for you. Michael did have an IRA rollover from his pharma job, about $450,000. And when Brooke retired from her teaching job, she rolled her 403B into a variable annuity, $200,000. They also had some cash at the bank, around $50,000. The challenge was, again, that their portfolio wasn't really producing enough income to cover that gap between what they were spending and what they were earning from their Social Security and from Brooke's pension. So they were drawing down the cash in their banking accounts to meet their living expenses. And Michael was sort of watching this trend and thinking, this is not a good trend. We've got to turn this trend around somehow. So essentially what we had to do was retool their situation a little bit and figure out how to make their assets more productive for them in terms of producing income, looking at ways to reduce their expenditures so that they could have a nice, healthy retirement in terms of lifestyle without fretting all the time about reducing their principal and drawing down their principal while they're in retirement.
And here's what we did, Kathleen, because as we mentioned, when you move into retirement, what you want to do is minimize the cost of housing. Because really what you're dependent on now, you're no longer working. So you want as much income coming in that will guarantee your basic living expenses and also the kind of lifestyle things that you want to do. Travel, golf, sail, whatever it is that are hobbies of yours. If you have a lot of your net worth tied up in your home isn't producing income. So what you want is you want the basic shelter. You want to live in a nice neighborhood or a retirement community. The problem with the Bullocks is the equity in their home was almost as big as their investment portfolio. I mean, they had $600,000 in equity. They had about $650,000 of assets, including all their cash, and they've been drawing down their cash considerably. The other thing is Brooke's 403B annuity had poor returns in it. A lot of teachers, if you're not familiar with the 403B plan, it's the equivalent of the 401k plan that we see in the private sector. So given all their assets were basically in bond funds and cash that was producing roughly about 3% returns, the problem was they had a $12,000 shortfall, meaning their basic expenses, and a $27,000 shortfall, meaning their total expenses. Investment income of $15,000 simply was not cutting it.
Jim, I think the challenge here with this couple was really just trying to completely rethink their entire portfolio of assets, but it involves some pretty tough choices for this couple. You know, as we've mentioned, they did have a lot of equity tied into their home, but they were here in California because they actually had two kids here. You know, one of them was married, one of them was single, but they also had a daughter who was living in Phoenix. So we started thinking about, okay, they've got this significant shortfall in their assets. They've got one of their assets, which is a significant portion of their net worth that's not producing any income. Maybe we need to explore with this couple what would happen to their cost of living and their assets' ability to produce income for them to live on if we just spec out what happens if they move to another state. Let's just say Arizona, because they've got a daughter that lives there. This decision to move to a cheaper state in retirement can create a major difference in terms of your retirement costs and your quality of life. So, Jim, why don't we discuss the plan we came up with for the Bullocks in terms of making this move?
Well, one of the things that we really began to talk about, because they had their oldest daughter that was living in Phoenix, was they would often go over there to visit their daughter and their grandchildren. They also had two kids, one married, one not, here in California. But they also noticed, and they had friends in Arizona as well, because Arizona is a big retirement community. If you look at Sun City and Sun City West, they had thought in the back of their mind, maybe someday we may want to move there because the cost of living was cheaper. And after going through their plan, we decided that that was going to be the best move. And they had gone over there. They go over there during the holidays to visit their daughter, and they start looking at the cost of housing. To make a long story short, the decision was made that the house would be sold and put on the market, especially since the real estate market had started to pick up in Southern California. Their home wasn't worth exactly what it was at the peak, but it had come back considerably. You know, now was the time to take advantage of that rather than wait for another housing downturn. So they decided to sell their house. We'll talk about the difference. But the first thing it did, number one, it eliminated mortgage payments of almost $1,600 a month, roughly about $1,550. That was a savings of over $18,000 a year. I mean, think about that, over $1,500 a month savings. The second thing is property taxes here in California compared to Arizona was a major difference. The property taxes over there in Sun City are closer to 0.5%, where the property taxes here are over 1%. So there was almost $5,000 in property tax savings. So the combination of eliminating a mortgage and reducing the property taxes was almost $24,000 a year. Now think about that from an expense point of view of almost $2,000 a month. Now what they ended up doing is they ended up buying a home in Sun City that was roughly 179,000, 2,000 square foot home, needed some updating, a little older home, so they wanted to update the kitchen, appliances, counter, etc. So there were about $20,000 worth of upgrades that they put in their home. So overall, about $200,000, selling their house here, close to $900,000. They netted around $850,000 after real estate commissions and, of course, a $300,000 mortgage. But they walk away from their home with $550,000, $200,000 going to have a paid-for, free-and-clear home, which Brooke really liked, considering the age difference and longevity between them. But living in a house, no mortgage payments, debt-free, and also freeing up $350,000 for investment. So here, there was a significant cost savings, not only in taxes, and we haven't even got to income taxes yet, just in property taxes, eliminating a mortgage was a significant difference in pulling out some of that equity in the home that wasn't producing any income.
So basically what we had them do was that when they sold their home, they took the equity out of that home and took a portion of that equity and purchased a home in Sun City West, and the remainder we were using to produce income from them using investments. So paying cash for their home out in Sun City West meant they had no mortgage expense, which, as Jim just mentioned, really reduced their monthly cost of living. Obviously, and when I think about this, getting a 2,000 square foot home for $179,000, Jim, you could never do that here.
No, that would probably buy you, what, a garage?
A garage, half an apartment, maybe. So for a lot less money, they got a lot more house. So again, the home cost was much, much cheaper, got a really nice size home at a really nice price point. Again, the property taxes, the income taxes were cheaper. You know, they went from a 9.3% tax rate in California to a 4.24% tax rate in Arizona. That's more than a 50% cut in the amount of income tax they pay to the state. So Jim, this sort of just summarized some of the changes we made that saved some of their cost of living and improved their quality of life. Why don't you talk a little bit about the investment changes that we made with this additional $350,000 that we now had to work with in terms of investment portfolio?
Well, the first thing that I want to emphasize here in the major difference to the Bullocks came in reducing their basic living expenses from $70,000 here in California, which included a mortgage, to $45,000 in Arizona. So we eliminated the mortgage, property taxes dropped more than half, and also lower income taxes. So what that did is it freed up, after paying cash for a house, including the improvements, it freed up about $350,000, which was added to their existing $650,000 portfolio. So now we had close to $1 million worth of assets versus $600,000 working to produce income. So we not only increased the portfolio size, we also increased the returns by putting half of that instead of a bond fund into a laddered bond portfolio close to 4%. That produced about $20,000 of income and about $500,000 in blue chip stocks, because we wanted that inflation protection, because Brooke was obviously younger than Michael. So we needed inflation protection for those future years. So at 2.5%, that was $12,500. So expenses, which were $85,000 before their plan, investment income was $15,000. The first thing that happened is basic living expenses dropped to $45,000. But here's what we did. This is kind of a twist on this story, is we increased their lifestyle expenses. We doubled it from $50,000 to $30,000. And the idea was, instead of owning a home here in California, they would come here for the summer months where they could get a rental for 3 months. That way they could be close to their two kids that lived here, their friends that were here as well, and also escape the heat in Arizona, which, if you live there, you know what it's like. I lived there for 28 years, where the temperatures can get to 115 during the summer. So we increased their lifestyle expenses. So their total expenses dropped from $85,000 to $75,000. Their investment income went up by $17,500. expenses went down $10,000, the total change in their lifestyle was almost $28,000 a year. That came from increased returns, number two, freeing up the equity of their home to move some of that into an investment portfolio, and the reduction of expenses by getting rid of mortgage expenses and reducing their taxes. So the net delta, Kathleen, was almost $28,000.
Well, I think this is great and from a financial point of view, but I think there's also the personal side too. So on the financial side, basically what we did by moving is they moved into a free and clear home, so no more mortgage expense every month, reduced cost of living in terms of groceries, gas, etc. Their taxes were reduced, their living expenses were reduced. The other thing this move did for them is it freed up additional capital to produce income for them, about $350,000. So like you said, the financial side of the picture was that they ended up $28,000 ahead of where they were before, which is no small number. Okay, so that's the financial side of the picture. What about the personal side of the picture? So they got to spend time in California in the summer. They could still see their married kid who lived out here and their single kid who lived out here. But again, then they spent time with the rest of their family in Arizona. So they got to be near all their kids, the California kids and the Arizona kids. So moving from an expensive state to an inexpensive state made a huge difference for this couple. It eliminated their mortgage expense. It reduced their property and income taxes. They didn't have to sacrifice their quality of life. You know, they had the Phoenix Mayo Clinic nearby. They actually got to enhance their lifestyle. You know, California now became this new vacation destination for them rather than their primary living location. And like I mentioned, they got to spend time with all three of their kids. And the other thing is, Jim, now instead of dipping into their savings every year, they had surplus income of around $16,000 a year. That is a huge difference just from making a change, making a move to a cheaper state in retirement. Now, obviously those numbers aren't going to be the same for everyone, but if you live in a high tax state and you're thinking about trying to reduce expenses or change things around when you retire, maybe it's time to start crunching some of those numbers about some of these cheaper states and see just how much of a financial difference it could make if you make that type of a move.
Well, that concludes the first portion of today's program, but stay tuned. We have some great things coming up. Kathleen is going to be talking to Carolyn Rosenblatt, an RN, and also an elder law attorney, about aging, financial capacity issues, the ability to manage financial affairs, often the first part of memory and self-care to go. All of that coming up right after this.
Welcome to the second half of today's program on Financial Sense News Hour's Lifetime Income segment. Now, I know that most of us have noticed that from time to time, we tend to forget a few things. Maybe we put our keys someplace and can't remember where we put them, or we run across someone that we know that we know their name, but it's just not coming to us. Today's program is about, when does memory loss become a problem when it comes to dealing with your financial affairs? When should you start to be worried about memory loss in your finances, and why should you be worried? Today's guest is Carolyn Rosenblatt, who was a registered nurse for 10 years and then went into law, practicing as an elder law attorney. She's also a mediator. One of her areas of expertise is helping families mediate and negotiate all of the really difficult relationship issues and financial issues that come up as someone ages and starts to lose capacity in their control over their finances. So following a conversation with Carolyn Rosenblatt about memory loss and when and why you should be concerned for your loved one. Well, Carolyn, you've mentioned that this is definitely an issue for people who are aging. What exactly do you mean when you talk about having a loss of financial capacity?
Well, financial capacity is kind of a vague term to most people because it hasn't been defined very well for the general public, but there is considerable research that's been done on this subject, particularly by Dr. Daniel Marson, who is the preeminent researcher in the country. He and many of his colleagues have delved into how you define financial capacity and broken it apart into different domains, they call them. But it's a very complex problem, a very complex concept. It consists of a lot of discrete abilities that have to do with judgment, discerning the nuances of a decision, being able to do simple things like paying bills and making change. It's really much more than you would think when you just talk to somebody and say, oh yeah, he seems alert, he's got financial capacity.
So financial capacity really goes above and beyond an issue of just general mental capacity, which is a term we often hear a lot when it comes to elder care or issues involving aging parents or aging loved ones. We hear this whole idea about general capacity or incapacity a lot, but financial capacity is kind of like a really specific subset of that, correct?
Yes, it's very different, in fact. It is, according to the research, and I've been following Dr. Marson's research at the University of Alabama at Birmingham for years now, it is really probably the first thing to erode when a person has the early stages of dementia or the beginnings of cognitive impairment. The financial ability that that person has for the complexities of decision-making is what slips away first. They can be fine with other things, totally able to take care of themselves. They can be driving a car. They can be traveling. But they may already be losing their financial capacity.
In a way, it's almost a very subtle type of capacity loss because it's not something you're generally not going to know if a loved one's having trouble paying their bills or making financial decisions, at least until things just sort of start to get a little bit messy, because it's not something you generally talk to people about. So what are some of the warning signs or some of the things that you should maybe consider asking an aging loved one to sort of probe for problems with this specific type of loss of capacity?
Well, I think it starts with the idea that we can't expect our aging parents or our aging loved ones to stay the same forever. People begin to decline as they age, most typically. Most people start to lose some of their abilities. One of the very earliest warning signs that we see is memory loss, becoming forgetful. It's different when someone has brain disease like dementia or Alzheimer's disease from somebody who just says, gosh, you know, the name of that guy is on the tip of my tongue. I just can't think of it. And then an hour later, they think of it.
Right. Or I forgot my keys. I can't find my keys. Where'd I put my keys?
Yeah. And then you remember. But a person with brain disease can't remember at all. They don't think of it later. So that's a subtle discrimination, but we need to be looking for it. If your mom or dad, for instance, forgets that you're coming over and you've reminded them that you're coming for a visit, in fact, you called them an hour ago and said you're on your way and then they're surprised to see you, that would be kind of a typical thing. Forgetting to pay the bills, and this is getting to be very common and sometimes it's very dangerous because if they forget to pay, say, their long-term care insurance premium and it gets canceled, there's a real issue there for all the money that they've spent. So, you know, the utilities get turned off, the collection notice comes in the mail, something gives the family member a warning sign that things are amiss. That's where you notice it. And you've got to be involved with a loved one enough to be able to look over those things. And I think that's what's critical. The roles between parent and child have to change.
So you sort of have to get in some way permission from the aging loved one to be more involved in their sort of the operations of life, if you will, in terms of reviewing the incoming and outgoing mail, reviewing what's happening with their financial life, etc. I was noticing recently, we do different types of insurance contracts and annuities here, and I've noticed when I've called on the phone to service different contracts, what I'm hearing is a message as I'm on hold about having a secondary address that's authorized to receive mail for these contracts, which makes me wonder if the insurance companies have caught on to this issue, especially with long-term care insurance lapsing, is that it's helpful to have a secondary person authorized to receive duplicate copies of notification of policy lapse.
That's a nice concept. It's a good idea generally, but it does not go far enough. You have privacy considerations and you have the risk of abuse. So those two things can sometimes get in the way. I think what all financial people need, that is people in the industry who are selling any kind of product to the public or maintaining any kind of client relationship over a financial item, you have to have a way to deal with the possibility, the very realistic possibility, that someday that client might lose their capacity to make decisions. Having another address where you send duplicate statements does not go far enough. What if you need to talk about that individual? What if you call them on the phone and say, gee, I just wanted to give you a heads up. You've been my client for 10 years. We didn't get your premium payment. I'm doing this as a courtesy to you. And they can't keep track of what you're saying. You're on notice that that person has a problem. So what can you do? Do you have permission for talking to a family member? Do you even know who a family member might be? When there's an additional address, do you even know where that statement is going? What if somebody's taking money from the client?
which is a real concern.
Yeah, there's real concerns, and some policy changes need to happen so that the industry as a whole addresses this in a much more proactive way than it has up to this point.
I'm really interested in what you have to say about policy change. What sort of policy change would you hope to see? Because obviously, in any financial services industry institution, there's a huge privacy concern. And so I know for us, we actually ask our clients to give us backup contact information where they sign off that we have permission to talk to a third party if we can't reach them, or we reach them and we're having a hard time communicating with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a gentle way of saying, if we notice something's wrong with your decision making, we have authorization to contact a third party to discuss what's going on.
Right.
What sort of a policy change do you think would help not only financial institutions, but individuals get a better handle on this whole idea of a loved one losing financial capacity?
I think that getting permission to talk to another person is a good start, but there is no uniformity, probably even within your own company, about what the criteria are that trigger your permission. The permission may not be very specific. It should be in writing, and it should be dealt with by your legal and your compliance people. You know, we help people develop those policies. I have a whole curriculum about this at our new website called aginginvestor.com. Part of the effort is to help establish how you create new policies that anyone can understand, that anyone can follow, and that have a standardized way of addressing the issue when it comes up. For instance, if you are talking to a client and you think there's something wrong because you're not getting through, or they're kind of vacant when you talk to them, whatever it is that puts you on notice of the problem, you need to know what the next steps are. And they need to be clarified, and they need to be written, and everybody needs to be adhering to them in the same way. And that takes some thinking and planning and some training. But I think overall, if you just put a general statement about it, I would say that we need the equivalent of a healthcare directive, a financial care directive. We have in the healthcare field a good model. We say, if you can't speak for yourself, you can articulate who you want to take care of you and what you want them to do with those critical decisions. We don't have any equivalent document in the financial services field, and families do not have any collaboration about that. If they have in their estate planning, for example, a durable power of attorney, that's not really going to work very well for the institution, because the institution wants its own power of attorney. So there's a conflict there when it comes to the law. But I think that if there were agreement between the professions, and if the financial services professionals learned from the legal field about how we deal with these issues of privacy, because we've got the same considerations you do as lawyers, then I think we could do much better than we're doing. And we would have a much more proactive way to prevent the disasters that happen when people have not articulated anything and nobody knows what to do.
I think you're bringing up a really good point in terms of standardization, which I think is really important to make sure that everyone is sort of on the same page as far as what happens, what does loss of financial capacity mean, you know, what are the points at which we can actually proceed forward with that financial directive as an institution. But I'm also thinking about some of the drama that surrounds getting involved in a loved one's financial affairs in terms of family dynamics.
Yeah.
So can you speak a little bit about that as far as the family dynamics involved with getting involved with a loved one's financial affairs?
Yes, of course. And at my current business, agingparents.com, my husband, who's a psychologist, and I have the background to work with families, and that's what we do. But I can tell you that this issue of privacy and secrecy even around finances is a rampant problem. Part of it is sort of the age cohort that we're dealing with now that are our elders. They've lived through the Depression, World War II, a lot of deprivation, a lot of disasters around finance in their era. And there was a sort of cultural acceptance of the idea that you don't talk about money. And that carries over, unfortunately, into families. So if you're talking about grandpa who's 90, and he's got some funds, and nobody knows what he wants to do if he becomes incapacitated, asking him to talk to you about where he wants his money to go, not in his will, but during the time that he might be incapacitated, who's going to be tending to his portfolio, who will be deciding whether to buy or sell securities, those kinds of questions are going to be very difficult for him to confront, because first of all, there's this resistance that's built in culturally by the way he grew up and lived through these times, but also because no one has ever addressed this in the past and said, look, you know, you've got to have a necessary conversation with your family about how you're going to deal with this possibility that as you get older, you might need help. And you have to really decide who's going to be the helper. And we need to have this discussion because we don't want you to leave us flat-footed with no idea. We want to honor your wishes. And a lot of people don't have the information or the skill set to have these conversations. That's part of what we teach people to do. But you are right. It is difficult. There's resistance. People don't want to face that they may become disabled. They don't even want to sign their estate planning documents for the lawyer.
That's the whole idea of, you know, I'm not going to live forever.
I mean, look at our culture. We say, you know, in case anything ever happens to me, instead of, you know, when I die. Excuse me.
Exactly.
There's no in case, and it's not an if. So we have an anti-death kind of bias in our culture, which is unfortunate because it is responsible for a lot of these problems.
You've mentioned that you have a website, agingparents.com, that might have some tools to help people know how to start these conversations with their families. I'm also thinking about, okay, so you have this conversation with the family member about how to handle financial affairs if and when they become incapacitated. What's the follow-up to that? Do you make a written document everyone in the family knows about?
Sure.
These are the agreements we've made as far as what does it mean that I've lost enough capacity for someone to step in and this is who I've decided is going to step in. Do you have something in writing? What's kind of the best next step once you've had that conversation?
Well, we have in the law already, and most estate plans contain, a durable power of attorney. So if you lose capacity, this is something different from what, say, a bank gives a person. A power of attorney is a document by which the person deciding to appoint an agent gives that agent permission to do certain things. And there's a standard form for a durable power of attorney in California that you can download free on the internet. Okay? You don't have to get a lawyer to do this. Good to have legal advice if you're not sure what it means or if you have questions about how to decide on the agent. It's a very heavy-duty document because it basically gives someone permission to open up your checkbook and do whatever they want. You know, the law says you're supposed to do this for the benefit of the person who appointed you, but there's a lot of theft out there, unfortunately. But the bottom line is that people don't want to go spend a few $100 and see a lawyer and get it done if they haven't already. They don't have to. They can get it free. And the missing piece here is that the financial institution, the financial service professional, doesn't have that and doesn't have a reciprocal or similar kind of document that says, okay, I'm Joe Blow in charge of your finances over here at XYZ Financial, and I am the one who decides if your particular stock that you've owned for a while is losing value, it's time to sell, I need to get your permission. I contact you to get that permission, and I can't talk to you because you're out of it. I need to know who to call and what they have permission to do. So you see, there needs to be a reciprocal kind of thing, the equivalent of a power of attorney, a financial directive, I'll call it, so that the advisor or planner or wealth manager knows who he or she has the right to call and what they have the right to ask that agent to do.
So I think this whole idea of having, you know, a specific power of attorney or something similar, a financial power of attorney or what have you, mm-hmm. is a great concept. I think what I see happening a lot is that I see the impetus to have these documents created and signed left too late.
Yeah.
Until the person has lost so much capacity, they're not legally capable of signing those documents. So at what point should someone start having that conversation about we really need to get these documents taken care of with their loved one?
You raise a very good point because there is no proactive mandate within your industry, nor within families, that there's a certain age when you have to get this planning done. Every estate planning lawyer out there is going to say, get it done now. Doesn't matter what your age. If you have anything at all, you should have some kind of will. Even if you write it yourself, even if you get a book from, you know, the library and do it, or you download a form from the internet, get something done, okay? There are some people who say there's a 40-70 kind of rule or thought, which is that you should deal with this by the time you're 40 and your parent is 70. I think for your side of the picture, which is financial services, every time you sign up a new client, you should have this document in place. It should be required so that they disclose to you who it is that they would want. Because we're not just talking about the problems of aging alone. They are paramount now because of our rapidly burgeoning aging population, soon to be swelled even further by the baby boomers, who are now over 65 at the leading edge. But it is for people who become disabled from something else, from a stroke, from a fall, from a head injury, from a bad drug reaction. It could be anything that disables a person. and we don't have in place a uniform standardized requirement that when they sign up for any broker, dealer, advisor, wealth manager, financial planner, or advisor, that they have to sign something that does what we've been talking about, that gives permission to someone else to be contacted. And that's one thing that I think needs to change. I think it needs to happen at the outset of professional services. And for families, pick a birthday. Make it be 65. Make it be 70. Make it be when you retire. Make it be whatever you want, so that there's a marker in place that families say, okay, this is it. And some leader in the family says, we need to sit down and create this. And we need to give this to your financial manager, too.
So if this is the process where someone still has enough capacity to sign these legal documents, the estate planning, the will, the power of attorney, the trust document, what's the process if someone passes that point of being legally capable of signing documents, but someone has to be able to pay their bills, make decisions for them, handle their daily living needs? What sort of becomes the process then? So if you have a loved one who's aging, who's showing signs of memory loss, but they pass the point of being legally capable of signing a document, what's the process that happens then to permit someone to help that person continue living?
There's no choice anymore if they're not capable of signing anything. The family is forced to seek the court to give them a conservatorship in California, also called a guardianship in other states. There's no choice. And I'll tell you a real example. These were clients of mine. Two sisters, very close to their stepdad. Mom had died long ago. Stepdad was lovely to them. He was a wealthy man. He had lots of money in the bank, but he got dementia, which is why he had to retire. And he gradually began to lose capacity. He had done estate planning, but he had never signed a power of attorney. And the lawyer, I'm sorry to say, I'm embarrassed to claim this as my legal brethren, had not finished the job of making sure that this gentleman had signed the proper documentation to allow his stepdaughter or stepdaughters to take charge of things like his IRA, which was in his name only. Okay, they were beneficiaries after he died, but he's not dead, okay? So he gradually, you know, needs caregiving. They hire the caregivers. They're taking care of him. He's able to get by with, you know, they were on one of the bank accounts, so they managed to pay for things until he ran out of money in his bank account. At that point, he had to get into his IRA, okay? They did not have a power of attorney. The people who were custodians of the IRA could not let them in. He desperately needed the money or he was not going to have any caregiving. And so they had to go to court and get a conservatorship. It takes thousands of dollars. You have to hire an attorney. Even if it's a case like this, it was easy to prove that he was incapacitated because they had plenty of doctor's reports and evidence. Still have to hire an attorney, petition the court, wait for the court to appoint an attorney for him, have the attorney for him verify that the documents say that he really is disabled, and then have the court grant the conservatorship, and then have the conservator, who in this case was the stepdaughter, appointed. That process took several months.
And in the meantime, bills are piling up.
Yeah, the bill is piling up, and you can skip all that aggravation if you do the right thing at the outset. And it's not always so easy to get a conservatorship. If the person is kind of half out of it and half with it, I call that the gray zone. They're not totally competent. They're not totally incompetent, but they're not competent for financial decisions. So you say, okay, well, we don't have anything from you. We have to get a conservatorship. They resist. They fight it. They get a lawyer. The lawyer says, oh, well, you know, we're not going to let this happen. Take away your freedom. The fight is on. You can spend $50,000 on a disputed conservatorship. So we really encourage people to be proactive.
Question, is the court required to appoint a family member as conservator, or does the court have discretion in the appointment of the conservator?
The court has discretion, but the court always prefers to appoint a family member unless the family member is deemed unfit, and that would be proven by evidence. Maybe they've stolen, or they're a drug addict, or they've already taken money from mom or dad's account to start with, and somebody else needs to be appointed. When there is no family, the court typically appoints a professional licensed fiduciary. Fiduciaries are licensed in the state of California. They are not licensed in every state. And if the person doesn't have any money, the Office of the Public Guardian will supply a fiduciary, and they will all pay themselves out of the elder's account.
So this is a really big deal.
Oh, yeah, real big deal. And, you know, it's much more serious than people realize. I'm making this impassioned plea that both people who are out there with aging loved ones and people in the financial services industry start reckoning with this problem better than we've been doing. You know, we have a $2.9 billion a year problem of financial elder abuse in this country. I would really like to see that change.
I'm really glad you brought up this issue of it's sort of a specific form of elder abuse, which is financial abuse.
Yes.
We've seen this happen quite a bit in our industry, obviously, with, you know, maybe mom or dad is aging, their decision-making with financial affairs starts to get a little bit shaky. Son or daughter steps in and says, here, mom or dad, let me help you. And son or daughter starts siphoning off money from the parent's account. So we've talked a lot from the perspective of the child or the loved one of the aging person. Is there any action that the aging person, him or herself, should do or take to protect him or herself from this financial abuse, not just from family members, which is probably one of the most common, but also from strangers as well?
Yes, it's a very sticky wicket because family members steal the most from elders. I mean, this has all been researched. They steal the most often. Caregivers are second, and financial industry professionals are third.
Oh, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed that we're on that list.
Okay, well, here's the bad news about that. Financial industry professionals steal the most money. So dollar value, highest with the financial services folks, obviously they have access to the most. If they've got somebody's million-dollar portfolio, they can divert the whole thing and think nobody's going to catch them. But they do get caught and prosecuted. 7,000 claims a year filed with the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. But back to your question, what can they do? The first thing needs to be making the best possible choice of agent on a durable power of attorney or appointing someone to be trustee. Because when there's a trust, the elder is usually the trustee until they become incapacitated. And then the trust always contains a provision that someone else will take over as the successor trustee. More thought needs to go into that. And lawyers need to be more assertive about insisting that you don't just appoint your son because he's your son. You appoint whoever is the best person, the most capable person, not your favorite, because you like them and you both enjoy watching sports together. It has to be someone who's competent. The elder himself or herself needs to teach the family member about the portfolio, how to handle it, how to manage it, what their investment philosophy has been, so that they're prepared for the job. This is where the elders fall down.
Sort of a mentoring process, a financial mentoring process in a
way. Yes. If it's children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, the more money they have, the more they need to do this. But this process of sharing information, teaching, preparing heirs is a critical step that a lot of families fail to take, which accounts for the fact that 70% of wealth transfers fail. That is, the next generation loses control of the money because really lack of communication to start with. And if the trust and communication in the family is improved, the outcomes of wealth transfers are likely to also improve because that is the major undermining force, is the lack of trust and communication. So what does that mean? That means that if grandpa has a business and a portfolio, grandpa needs to be preparing the next in line, the people he is going to give that gift to upon his death, to be prepared to handle it. They need to know how to run that business. Or if they're going to sell it, they need to be prepared for what they would do to sell it. If they have a stock portfolio, for example, they would need to know what grandpa's investment philosophy was. If he wants that to continue, theoretically at least, after he passes, they would need to know that he likes conservative things or he likes green investing or whatever it is he likes so that they can, if they want to, carry on that tradition to honor his wishes. But at least they will know how to do what he wants them to do if they choose to take that path. And likewise for general financial education, every person, especially the women in the family, need to be ready to step up and understand on equal footing with their husbands and brothers how to manage money, because the gift, what it boils down to is money. It may be in different forms. It could be invested in real estate or annuities or securities or whatever it's invested in, but they need to understand those investments and how to handle them and what changes need to happen if the economy shifts, which is, of course, it's going to do. And that financial education can really be a joint effort between the elder, the matriarch or the patriarch who's got the asset, who earned it in the first place, and the financial services professional who is in a perfect position to participate in the education because they understand the investments better than anybody. So we see a real need there, and that's part of why we have aginginvestor.com, is to teach families and financial people how to do that, how to have those conversations and make them productive.
You know, I was thinking as you've been talking about this, Carolyn, is that the statistic you just cited that 70% of wealth transfers fail.
Yeah.
In terms of the success of the receiving generation to handle the investments or assets or inheritance.
Right.
That is staggering.
It's staggering. And it's based on Williams and Pricer, who did a study of 3,250 high net worth families. And they looked at what happened to the money over time, wrote this up. And, you know, that statistic, as far as I know, has not been challenged. It's not just a matter of how many trillions of dollars of wealth are changing hands because of this generation dying off and the boomers getting it and then the boomers handing it off. It's what happens to the money after the heirs get it. There are two different analyses that are taking place. But I think one where the financial services folks and families have a fabulous opportunity to work together is now, so that the recipients of the gifts of the elders in the families that are starting to take place and are taking place as we speak, those things can be preserved to honor the intention of the person who earned the money in the first place.
This is so important. And I think, you know, especially you're talking about a generation where it was either vulgar or not acceptable or was too personal to talk about money.
Right.
So you've got this going on. But I'm thinking as we're talking here, so let's just say for the sake of argument that you've appointed your daughter to be your successor trustee, to be your power of attorney, if you lose capacity, etc. If you don't trust her enough to open up to her now about your situation and what you're doing, why are you trusting her enough to fill that role either after you're incapacitated or after you're gone?
Exactly. And, you know, the question of gift giving, I don't think is probed deeply enough by a lot of lawyers. They're not very responsible about challenging their own clients because they just want to do the job and get paid, or whatever the reason. Maybe they just don't have the skill. You know, I'm sorry to say they don't teach communication skills in law school. Okay? I learned it in nursing school very well before I was ever allowed to touch a patient. We had 6 months of communication skills training, and it was stranded, as they called it, throughout the curriculum the entire time that I was in nursing school, which was 5 years. We learned about how to talk to people without offending them, how to bring out difficult subjects. We were talking about life and death, you know, life-threatening illness. I mean, this was not lightweight subject matter here. But when you compare that with what lawyers learn, they don't learn how to talk to people. And so here they are vested with this enormous responsibility of planning someone's estate, and they don't have the skill set that you need to teach the person who has the gift that they want to give to heirs how to communicate the nuances of what to do with that, how to work with the family to teach the next generation or generations how to manage, successfully retain that wealth and grow that wealth. That's missing. So I'm saying, okay, we have another whole field here, which is the people who are currently managing the assets, and they can be brought into the conversation, and perhaps with enough instruction, they will be open to learning the skill set of facilitating these intergenerational communications, these family meetings. They're in a great position. I just don't see it as part of the curriculum in what you learn either.
To be honest, it's really not. It's something our industry is really struggling with right now. But even the fact that you say to me that if I'm a wealthy individual, there's a 70% chance of failure of my wishes and desires being carried out from my estate.
Yeah.
That's a huge rate of failure for me. And I would think that it would basically be a wake-up call to all our listeners in that situation to ask themselves, if I'm not trusting my successor trustee, my appointed agent on my power of attorney with my financial information now, that essentially implies that I don't really trust them to fill out those wishes after I pass away. We've talked a lot about appointing family members, which is most common, which also can cause family drama, which is a topic, a whole separate topic. But what about appointing a licensed fiduciary?
Well, we recommend that when sometimes they don't have any reliable offspring, okay? But they've got offspring and they want to take care of them. So, yes, fiduciaries are an excellent way to deal with that. You have to be careful about the fiduciary because some of them are not as compassionate or skilled as we would like them to be, despite the fact that we license fiduciaries in California since 2009. Nevertheless, you know, that is the last stop for most people. There isn't anybody else. You can appoint a friend. You could have a committee of friends. There are different ways to go about this, but in order to protect yourself the most, it's good to have a licensed person.
I agree, and I think especially for folks where, you know, appointing a family member could cause drama or there isn't a trustworthy family member to appoint, I think it's a really good option.
Yeah, Yeah, we had a case where this actually occurred. We had three sisters. They were fighting with each other to the point where nobody could make any decisions. Dad was very wealthy. He had dementia. They at least had enough sense to start by appointing a fiduciary. Their fighting continued, and it was all about taking care of Dad. So they at least had the sense to talk to the fiduciary, and the fiduciary contacted us about mediating their conflict. So we did that. They lived in three different states. One of them lived near Dad, and Dad had had a very contentious relationship with her, but this sounds very funny, but it's true. He fell and hit his head, okay, and it was like a reset button. He called up his daughter with whom he had this bad relationship, and he wanted to know when she was coming over for dinner. He completely forgot that he hated her before. So she then was the default person because she lived nearby to communicate with the other sisters. So we had to work with them. It took us four sessions of mediating their family conflict to the point where they all were in communication about Dad. They were able to text each other and talk about Dad and his care. We had the care manager in on one of the meetings, which was all by phone or Skype. And they were able to work things out to the point where Dad was happy, they were happy, everybody was at least managing to get along during this time period, and Dad suddenly died. But he went to his grave knowing at least a sense of comfort that the people around him were okay. The vibration, shall we call it, of what was going on was not stressful for him. And that was a very positive outcome for a family meeting.
So really, again, this whole concept of financial capacity, mentoring the next generation is extremely important. Carolyn, if our listeners are interested in learning more about some of these issues or contacting you, what's the best way for them to do so?
Our website is agingparents.com. Agingparents.com is for families. We do mediation, instruction, straight up advice. We have an advice sort of package of 4 hours that we give families, and we can deal with any family member about any aging issue they want. The other website for financial service professionals is aginginvestor.com. That's new. We offer training programs, assistance with policy development, workshops. We've got some very good materials that I think would be useful, and either one of those is a place where you can get in touch with us. And my phone number is 415-459-0413. That's 415-459-0413.
Well, Carolyn, I can't thank you enough for coming on the program to talk about these really important issues with aging. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome, Catherine.
So that concludes today's program. Our thanks again to Carolyn Rosenblatt for such a great conversation about memory loss in your loved ones and financial affairs. Speaking of financial affairs, if you need help with your financial future, thinking about it, planning for it, maybe you're worrying about it, give us a call here at PFS Group at 888-486-3939. My extension is 105, so you're welcome to call me directly. Again, that's PFS Group at 888-486-3939. Until next week, we hope you have great financial success.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.